The articles of impeachment are now out, and they charge President Trump with willfully inciting violence against the government of the United States in the speech that he made. The question is, two questions. Number one, was that speech constitutionally protected? And number two, if it was, can it be the basis for a constitutional impeachment? You'll hear my analysis of those two questions on The Dirt Show. The House of Representatives have just published their article of impeachment that calls for the removal of President Trump on the grounds of high crimes and misdemeanors. The article was drafted by one of my former students, a congressman who I greatly admire, Jamie Raskin, who tragically lost his son last week, and my deepest sympathy goes out to him. I remember Jamie as a student in my first year criminal law class. I remember Jamie's father. He was one of the defendants in one of the early anti-war cases. And isn't that ironic that Jamie Raskin, Congressman Raskin, is now drafting an article of impeachment that probably would have resulted in his father being convicted of anti-war demonstrations back against the Vietnam War. But because Congress is now going to be considering these articles of impeachment, today's show is going to be the class that Jamie Raskin missed, obviously, the seminar on why the First Amendment not only protects, but totally prevents the government from prohibiting exactly the kind of speech that President Trump gave last Wednesday in the Capitol. Let me be very clear. I do not approve of that speech. I don't think it was the right speech at the right time. I don't like the tone of the speech. I wish he hadn't given it. I think it hurt his presidency. I think it hurt his legacy. Obviously, that's a view shared by many in his administration, in the White House. But this is not about the quality of the speech or any disagreement. It's about whether the speech itself can form the basis for an impeachment. And that's exactly what the resolution does. It says that President Trump should be impeached because he, quote, engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors by willfully inciting violence against the government of the United States. And he betrayed his trust as president. He engaged in seditious acts were committed by the people who went to the Capitol. So these articles of impeachment, again, were I teaching a seminar at Harvard, I would try to structurally organize it in a relevant way. And the two questions that are raised is, was the speech itself constitutionally protected within the First Amendment? That's a serious issue. Was the speech protected? Could Congress constitutionally pass a law that would prohibit the making of that kind of speech? That's question one. That's not the end of the inquiry, because some would say, even if it was constitutionally protected, even if Congress couldn't pass a law prohibiting it, it could still serve as a ground for impeaching the president. So question number two is, can a constitutionally protected speech serve as the basis for his impeachment? So let's go over each of those issues in a systematic way. It will be on the test, so take careful notes and listen very, very carefully, because you're going to hear a lesson on the First Amendment to the Constitution. So we all know the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law, three dots, abridging the freedom of speech, also the right of the people peacefully to assemble to protest the actions of government. In its terms, the speech seems to fit exactly into both of those, but there's a 100-year history of jurisprudence. Back in the early days of the 20th century, before Louis Brandeis became a justice, there were a series of cases that allowed prosecution for assemblies and speeches of this kind. And in one of those cases, Justice Holmes issued his famous analogy, probably the most famous legal analogy ever published in the Supreme Court, basically saying even the most extreme views of freedom of speech would not permit someone falsely to shout fire in a theater, thereby causing a panic and resulting in people being hurt or killed. The shouting fire concept. It was never an apt analogy because shouting fire, as I've said before, is not a message to the brain. It's not a speech. It's not, gee, I'd like you to think about this. Here's the arguments for it. Here's the arguments against it. Shouting fire is a message to the adrenaline glands and to the legs. Get out of there. Don't think. Just get up and walk to the nearest exit. That's the message of shouting fire. It's exactly the same as if somebody went into a theater and set off an alarm without saying a word. Just set off an alarm, a fire alarm. Clearly, that would not be protected speech, and of course, neither is shouting fire. In fact, shouting fire isn't even speech. It's a clang sound. It's exactly the same as setting off an alarm. So it's totally irrelevant. In the case in which shouting fire came out, what happened was that anti-draft, anti-war people during the First World War were handing out a leaflet, a pamphlet, in front of a recruitment center. And the pamphlet said, we urge you to exercise your legal rights not to go to this war. The war is done by Wall Street. It's done for profiteering. You know, you imagine the Socialist Party put it out, what it would say. And Justice Holmes, in a wrong decision, which has been overruled, thankfully, in a wrong decision said, no, that's like shouting fire in a theater, and you can prohibit the publication of that pamphlet, even though all it called for was peacefully asserting one's rights not to be drafted as conscientious objectors. He said it would pose a clear and present danger of interfering with the war, the ongoing war effort. So the two concepts in that case were clear and present danger and shouting fire, both of which were expressly overruled in a case that occurred years later, more recently, in the late 1960s, called Brandenburg versus Ohio. So let me start by telling you what the speech was in Brandenburg versus Ohio. Remember, this was speech that was punished, criminalized. It was called basically the same, inciting, syndicalism, radicalism, virtually the same words as in the impeachment article. And here's what he said. This was Brandenburg, who was the head of the Ku Klux Klan and a Nazi. And he got up in front of a crowd of many, many thousands of people. And he said, quote, if our president, our Congress, our Supreme Court continues to suppress the white Caucasian race, it's possible there might have to be some revengeance taken. Didn't win any awards for semantics or for the use of language, but revengeance. That certainly sounds like a call to violence against the president, the Supreme Court, and others who are trying to put down the white race. And then he goes on. And if this sounds like President Trump's speech, this part of it, not the rest of it, obviously the rest was racist and bigoted and horrible, the speech made by the Klansman, Brandenburg, he then says, we are marching on Congress. We are marching on Congress. July 4th, 400,000 strong. We are marching on Congress, 400,000 strong. And then he said, personally, I believe, and then he uses the N-word for African Americans, a word I won't use on this show. I believe that the N-word should be returned to Africa. The Jew returned to Israel. And then the Supreme Court says, though some of the figures in the films, there were films that was evidence of this speech, carried weapons, the speaker did not. Many of the people in the film were wearing Ku Klux Klan hoods, including the speaker himself. The film showed, quote, six hooded figures, one of whom later identified as the appellant, repeated a speech very similar to that recorded in the first film, etc. And so by any standard, there is no comparison between the speech that President Trump made in which he called for peaceful, patriotic protests in front of Congress. Peaceful, patriotic. No reference to revengeance, no reference to violence, no reference to going into the Capitol, no reference to violating the law. That's Trump's speech. Compare that to Brandenburg's speech. Revengeance, march on the Capitol. There is no rational way, no thoughtful, intelligent, rational, objective person reading the Brandenburg case, a unanimous decision, can come to any conclusion other then that President Trump's speech falls well within the protected category of speech. It was not an immediate incitement, a direct immediate incitement. A direct immediate incitement would be not standing a mile away from the Capitol, but standing at the Capitol and screaming at the people, saying, now, break into the House of Representatives, break into the Senate, now, hit senators, now, commit violence, do it now, do it now. That's incitement. Under the Brandenburg decision, somebody could get up and say, I believe that you should, at some time, break into Congress. I think you should try to take direct action and hurt senators and congressmen. That's what I believe, and I'm advocating that you consider doing that. That, too, would be protected speech. Under Brandenburg, you can say, I advocate the violent overthrow of the government. Under Brandenburg, you can say, I want to take away the votes of African Americans, of women, of Jews. Under Brandenburg, you can call for a return of the monarchy. Under Brandenburg, you can advocate anything. You can get up there and say the earth is flat. Astronauts never landed on the moon. Elvis Presley is still alive. You can say anything you want because the First Amendment doesn't distinguish between truth and falsity. Yes, it does in defamation cases. That's a different matter. But when we're talking about general speeches, the United States government is a tyranny. You can say that. Communism is better than capitalism. You can say that. Take over Congress. Don't let them vote to make Joe Biden president. You can say that. That's all protected advocacy. And if you don't believe it, just go on Google and read Brandenburg versus Ohio. And I challenge anyone, any professor, I challenge Lawrence Tribe, the great professor of constitutional law, who never in his life saw a constitutional article or a constitutional provision that didn't somehow agree with his partisan politics. I challenge Tribe to tell me that he thinks that President's speech is outside the protection of Brandenburg. Even he wouldn't have the chutzpah to say that. I challenge any professor to write an article, to make a speech, to come on this show, and to tell me that Brandenburg versus Ohio doesn't cover that speech. Now, you might say Brandenburg versus Ohio was wrongly decided. All the justices of the Supreme Court, unanimous, conservative, liberals, per curiam opinion. You can say they all were wrong. That's a fair point. Under our Constitution, you have the right to criticize the Supreme Court. By the way, not under the petition that Harvard and Yale students are putting forward to try to get disbarred, Senators Hawley and Cruz. There they say that disrespect for the courts and disagreeing with court decisions may actually constitute a disbarrable offense. Nonsense. I have disagreed with more Supreme Court decisions than I've agreed with. I wrote books about it. I wrote a whole book disagreeing with Bush versus Gore and challenging the motives of the justices who voted 5-4 to stop the recount in Florida. I showed no respect for the Supreme Court in that book, and Justice Scalia let me know it in private conversation. But we agreed to disagree. He never said to me, Alan, I think you should be disbarred for saying I violated my oath of office. I accused Justice Scalia of violating his oath of office. I accused him of voting in favor of the Republican candidate because he was his favorite candidate for president. I accused him, if Shue were on the other foot, if it were not Bush versus Gore, but Gore versus Bush, of voting the other way. He hated it. He was furious at me. He let me know his anger, but he never suggested that I didn't have the right to say it. Of course I did. So we're coming to the end of the first part of the seminar. We're not going to take a break like we used to do at Harvard Law School, a coffee break. We're going to go right on to the second point. But on the first point, let us now stipulate as a fact, an undisputed, indisputable, clear fact that the speech made by President Trump that may in fact have been a but-for cause of the subsequent violence for which people should be prosecuted, that speech itself is constitutionally protected, that Congress could not pass a law, no state could pass a law, prohibiting any person, from the President of the United States to an ordinary person on the street to the head of the Ku Klux Klan, from making that speech. And let me stipulate one more thing. I would bet you that more than 100 speeches in the Capitol have gone much, much further than the speech President Trump made and have been deemed protected speech. I would bet you that if you go back in history and find the speeches of labor leaders calling on union members to go to Congress and protest, show how strong we are, don't back down, confront Congress. The other day I saw on television a Democrat who was making a similar speech saying, go to Congress, get in their face, get in their face. President Trump didn't say get in their face. Get in their face is not quite a call to violence, but it's a call to direct confrontation. Totally protected speech. Suffragettes marched on Washington. Go to the Capitol. Women have to have a right to vote. Confront the senators. Make sure they vote. Even sit-ins. Sit-ins have been called for. Sit-ins involve illegal trespassing. But calling for a sit-in, saying we want you to sit in illegally in Congress or in front of the Supreme Court or in other places, protected speech, undoubtedly protected speech, civil rights speeches, union speeches, all kinds of speeches, bad guy speeches. The Klan marched on Washington in the 1920s. Very, very, very similar. Black Lives Matter, good organization generally, except for its positions on defunding the police, on Israel, and a range of other matters. They've gone to Washington. The Million Man March, women's marches, repeatedly marches. Where do you go? You don't go to the football stadium. You go to the Capitol. That's where you show your protest. Or you go to the Supreme Court. There have been marches on the Supreme Court. There have been marches on the White House. Those are the symbols of authority and power. And that's where people assemble to protest the actions of government. The right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. President Trump had grievances. I don't agree with his grievances. Many of the people in that crowd had grievances. The Constitution doesn't say you can redress grievances that Alan Dershowitz agrees with. No, you can redress grievances that you believe in, that you think were grievances. So again, it is as clear as any constitutional principle could be that President Trump's speech was completely 100% constitutionally protected. Not a single word in it could be made the subject of a criminal prosecution. So that leads us to question two in our constitutional seminar today. If I'm right, and if the speech was constitutionally protected, could the speech become a basis for impeachment? The provision of the Constitution that calls for impeachment says a president may be impeached for treason. It's not treason. Treason is defined in the Constitution. Bribery, no money was passed. Or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Now, the provision of the article does accuse him not of treason or bribery, but of high crimes and misdemeanors. So the question is, can something be a high crime and misdemeanor if it's protected by the Constitution? Remember that the First Amendment was enacted after, subsequent to, an amendment to the body of the Constitution. And it's the body of the Constitution that lays out the criteria for impeachment, treason, bribery, other high crimes and misdemeanors. Obviously, that provision has to be interpreted in light of the First Amendment. It is inconsistent within the Constitution for saying that a president committed a high crime and misdemeanor when the same Constitution said the president couldn't commit a high crime and misdemeanor by giving a speech that was constitutionally protected. You can't make a constitutionally protected speech a basis for impeachment. It just makes no sense. It's inconsistent with the text of the Constitution, with the logic of the Constitution, with the order of the Constitution. And so these articles of impeachment are themselves unconstitutional. They violate at least three provisions of the Constitution. They violate the impeachment clause of the Constitution because he's being impeached on something that isn't a high crime and misdemeanor. They violate the First Amendment to the Constitution. And now I'll explain to you why they also violate the provisions of the Constitution that say that impeachment shall be used to remove a president from office. This impeachment is not designed to remove the president from office. Everybody knows that the president leaves January 20th at 12 noon. And he can be impeached before that. All you need is a majority vote of the House. Hamilton warned against using impeachment based on who has the most votes, but that's what the Democrats are doing with some Republicans. They're going to impeach him. Okay, but they're not going to remove him. And so the process is one that leads from impeachment to removal. And if you can't remove him, it's improper to impeach him. You can only impeach him as a first step to removal. For the same reason, you can only indict somebody as a first step to prosecuting him and giving him a chance to defend himself in court. Imagine a prosecutor getting up and saying, I know I can't win this case, so I'm not going to ever bring it to a jury, but I'm going to indict him so that he has an indictment hanging over his head for the rest of his life, even though I'm never going to give him an opportunity to prove his innocence. That would be clearly unconstitutional. And it would be unconstitutional, and it will be unconstitutional because it will happen. It will be unconstitutional for the president to be impeached with the knowledge that he can never be tried and removed by the Senate. Well, so they're going to come back and say, wait a minute, we don't have to remove him. The Constitution also provides that in addition, not as a substitution, but in addition to being removed, the word and comes, in addition to being removed, and he can also be disqualified from future serving in any office. So that's what we're doing. We're going to impeach him now while he's still president, and then we're going to try him after he leaves the presidency, not in order to remove him. We can't do that. He's gone. But in order to prevent him from running again, as I've said previously, if the Senate had the power to try somebody just to prevent him from running again, they could try me. I'm over 35. I'm born in America. I can run for president, and I'm sure there are a lot of senators who don't like me. And so they can haul me off the street, impeach me, and say, Dershowitz, you can never run for president of the United States or any other office. That's not what the framers intended with the impeachment provision. They intended it to be applicable only to sitting office holders, not people who have already left office and are ordinary citizens, which President Trump will become on January 20th. So in this seminar today, based on the impeachment articles that have been issued and will be voted on by the House of Representatives, two conclusions to me are absolutely clear. Number one, the president's speech was completely and totally protected by the First Amendment. Number two, a president cannot be impeached for making a speech that is completely and totally protected by the First Amendment and that Congress would not have the power to criminalize. You may agree, you may disagree. I don't know whether or not any of the social media will take down my statements because my statements are controversial. There are people who disagree with them, and it is appalling to see how many of the social media are now moving into the area of censoring political speech. Now, it's not a violation of the First Amendment. Brandenburg versus Ohio doesn't apply to Twitter. It doesn't apply to YouTube. It doesn't apply to Facebook. They are private companies like the New York Times and like CNN. They can decide what to put on and what not to put on their platforms. But it certainly violates the spirit of freedom of speech and the culture of the First Amendment. And particularly if any of these platforms are skewed in favor of one side or the other politically. And so, fortunately, we have some companies, some platforms like Rumble, where I'm proud to be on, and many of my subscribers subscribe through Rumble, which doesn't involve itself in these kinds of censoring decisions. We're now seeing a plethora of lawsuits. We'll see more. We're seeing lawsuits by Parler. We're seeing lawsuits against Amazon. We're seeing antitrust lawsuits brought by not only the federal government, but the state government. And I do think that when some of these platforms begin to work with other platforms together to deny Parler or others the opportunity to present their information in the court of public opinion, they invite more antitrust lawsuits. These are going to be very complex cases because the interaction between the First Amendment, antitrust laws, the private rights of people to operate in a free market society, these are all coming into conflict. And the next decade, I think, under the Constitution, will be a decade of challenging decisions regarding how the legislature, the courts, the executive deal with social media that have become the most powerful of formers of opinion and views and influence elections and influence attitudes and influence politics in the most dramatic and unpredictable ways the framers could never have imagined what the social media could do to freedom of speech and politics in the United States. And so I know a lot of you, my listeners and viewers, care deeply about freedom of speech, and this is Freedom of Speech Central. We're going to always focus on freedom of speech. And so let's turn now to some of our questions and some of our comments, which I know will focus not only on the impeachment, but on what's going on in social media today. Our first call is from Mike in New Orleans.
This is Mike from New Orleans. Professor, I keep rolling in my head what protections Parler might have from a legal standpoint. It's hard to call antitrust because Amazon is not in the business of social media necessarily. They're in the business of web hosting. But what kind of protection would, for example, Delta have if Delta Airlines convinced the manufacturer of jet fuels to stop selling fuel to American Airlines? Because that sort of seems like a similar situation. Yeah, if Twitter and Amazon got together and Twitter got Amazon to stop allowing Parler to use the servers, which are needed for online content, is there a legal standard there? Is there some sort of precedent that would be able to be in place? Just a thought running through my head. Thanks. Look forward to your comments.
It's a great thought, and it's a very interesting question. I think we're going to see some new antitrust law made as well as some new First Amendment law. These are groundbreaking questions that we don't know the answer to. You know, there's a big difference between applying the antitrust law to commodities that are bought and sold in the open market than applying it to speech platforms. And so the intersection of the First Amendment and antitrust laws will provide a lot of opportunity for the courts to be creative. Let's hope they use that creativity in a way that supports the culture of free speech. Our next question is from Jonas.
Hey, Dershowitz, my name is Jonas, and I got a quick question I wanted to push back on your comment. You said Twitter and Facebook can censor these politicians because they're private companies, but does it change if it is elected officials, such as AOC or maybe former Lady Michelle Obama, asking these people to do it, and does them taking federal money for maybe mask awareness and things like that complicate the issue that, well, you're taking federal money and leave them open to lawsuits? I love the show, and let me know what you think.
Thanks. So the answer to your first question is no. It doesn't matter that elected officials are telling him to do it. Elected officials have the right to tell them to do it. The fact that they're taking federal money is a little bit more complicated, and there have been cases going every which way on that, and it really depends on the nature of the money and the effect the money has. There certainly are circumstances where taking money make you into a government actor. It arises very often in the context of private universities, Harvard, Yale. They take money from the federal government, but yet they have their own First Amendment rights or academic freedom rights because they are independent. So again, these are cutting edge issues that I think we'll see some more attention being paid to in the years to come. Let's turn to our next caller.
Yes, I think calls for a third-party penalty of disbarment for Senator Cruz in Harlem is akin to a bill of attainder by the legislature. And I think that could apply also to the impeachment and or censure that's being debated or, you know, enforced by Nancy Pelosi. Because these things are assuming crimes that haven't been proven and punishing them nonetheless. And I don't think that that is legal. And I wish somebody would put a stop to this immediately. There is no crime here by anyone of their list that they're trying to punish. Thank you.
I completely agree with you that there's no crime, but the Bill of Attainder provision of the Constitution applies only to criminal punishments. It says that Congress may not do what the parliaments in many European countries were able to do. The parliaments were able to name specific people and say, this is a bill of attainder against King Charles or against this person in the government, and we hereby prosecute him and convict him and sometimes execute him. The United States Constitution explicitly prohibited that, along with ex post facto laws. But obviously, there's an exception for impeachment. Impeachment is in the Constitution itself, and so it's the only legislative authority to actually put people on trial, which is why they can't put somebody on trial after he leaves office. They just have no jurisdiction. Then it really does become akin to a bill of attainder if you have Congress, either the Senate or the House, trying a private citizen, and that would be prohibited both by the impeachment provision and by the spirit of the bill of attainder prohibition. Good question. Our next call is from Sean in Wisconsin.
Hi, Professor. My name is Shalom. I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I just wanted to hear your opinion on whether you think forced racial diversity training is constitutional or whether it constitutes racial discrimination that's being perpetrated on white people because they're white, whether or not they have racist views, and whether you would like to see some of these businesses sued for racial discrimination and have this practice stop.
There are really two points and two questions that your very excellent question raises. Number one, the distinction between government and private. If the government requires you to subject yourself to racial sensitivity training, it may actually be infringing on your freedom of belief. Tragically, but correctly, in America, you have a right to have beliefs that are inconsistent with diversity training. And so requiring you to essentially take a loyalty test to a certain form of diversity training, I think would be unconstitutional. By the way, diversity training is a misnomer. It's only about one form of diversity. It's not about intellectual diversity, ideological diversity. It's only about identity politics, racial diversity, which is an important element, but only one element. So the one issue is whether or not it violates, if it's governmental, freedom of conscience. The second issue is it discrimination? Because that would apply to private companies as well. Many states and the federal government have statutes prohibiting forms of racial discrimination. I think it would be most clearly presented if only white people were required to take these sensitivity training programs and others were exempted from it. That would raise questions of racial discrimination. I don't know how the court would decide that, but it's a very interesting question. Thanks. Our next call is from California. Mark?
On your January 11th podcast, you articulated the difference between yelling fire in a crowded theater, speech relaying an actual fact meant for debate, versus speech meant to encourage thought and reflection, even if repugnant to many. Accordingly, you characterized President Trump's speech to his minions on January 6th as speech intended to inspire reflection and therefore protected speech. My question is, doesn't context matter? If an audience is worked into a frenzy and hears words like, we can't take it anymore, you've got to fight, and our victory was stolen, is there a point when words can be considered akin to throwing a match onto gasoline? In context, don't President Trump's words move from rhetoric to a foreseeable cause of deadly action, like yelling fire in a theater, and lose their protected status? Thanks.
It's a great question, and your analysis is precisely the analysis Justice Holmes used in the Schenck case where he articulated fire in the theater. He talked about it. He said context matters, and the context he introduced was a theater. And that's been overruled. And the Supreme Court has basically said no. And the Brandenburg case proves that because context, the Brandenburg case, 400,000 people marching on the Capitol, send the black people back to Africa, send the Jews back to Israel, hoods, guns. There was all the context. And the Supreme Court said, no, we're going to look at the words. We're going to look at whether it's protected speech. The context matters in the sense of it helps you define incitement, but the words used by President Trump don't even come close. They're not anywhere near as incitement oriented as the words used by Brandenburg. He was saying march peacefully to the Capitol and protest patriotically. And then he, yes, used strong words, as labor leaders have, as suffragettes have, as civil rights workers have, as in Brandenburg, the Klan and the Nazi Party have. So it's exactly those kinds of, quote, fighting words that are protected by the Constitution. Our next call is from Susie in Florida.
Hi, Dr. Dershowitz. Really, really enjoy your show. Have learned a lot. My name is Susie. I'm calling from Tampa, Florida. And I have a question about this big tech censorship that seems to be coming out against conservatives. It seems like the entire establishment, from Forbes punishing people who've worked for the Trump administration, to the thing you mentioned about Trump's lawyers, to them going after Parler. I wanted to know, is there anything in the Constitution about one's effective right to free speech? Because I know the government can't come down and tell you, you may not say this, but if you're if the entire system in terms of other companies, if everybody, you know, banking, social media, if everybody just makes it so that you cannot live if you express a viewpoint, is that constitutionally protected, or could there be action taken against companies for basically forming a monopoly and just sort of freezing people out? Anyway, was just wondering if there was any legal precedent for that, and looking forward to your shows throughout the week.
Well, thank you so much. First of all, please, please, please don't call me Dr. Dershowitz. My wife is Dr. Cohen. She earned her PhD. I have, I think, 15 honorary doctorates. They're hanging on my wall. I have the robes that they gave me and the little hat. But I'm not entitled to be called doctor. I don't have a JD degree. When I went to Yale Law School, they just gave LLBs, Bachelor of Law. So I'm a happy Bachelor of Law. For $25, I could have turned in my Bachelor of Law degree for a Doctor of Law degree, but I found that a little pretentious. So I decided to give the $25 to charity and maintain my name as Mr. Dershowitz. You want to call me Professor? Fine. Don't call me doctor. Call Jill Biden doctor. She deserves to be called a doctor. She earned her doctorate, but Alan Dershowitz, plain ordinary Alan or Mr. or Professor, but not doctor. Look, the question you ask about antitrust laws and the First Amendment, the spirit of the First Amendment clearly has been violated by these social media platforms. But remember, they too have First Amendment rights. The First Amendment was designed to protect Google and YouTube and Facebook. They are holders of the First Amendment privilege. And the First Amendment means they have the right to decide what to publish and what not to publish. I remember in the Pentagon Papers, it was the New York Times that had the right, or New York Times versus Sullivan, the New York Times. So publishers have First Amendment rights as well. And the publishers' rights sometimes conflict with the readers', the listeners' rights. They're denying us the right to hear opposing points of view. CNN, for example, every day now denies its viewers and listeners the right to hear opposing points of view on impeachment. They just don't give their listeners the arguments you hear on the show, which is why we need shows like The Dersh Show and other shows where you hear a different point of view, especially if you watch CNN or MSNBC. You really have to listen to The Dersh Show, because otherwise, if you just hear one side over and over and over again, and there's no controversy, everything's simple, life's black and white, and there's no nuance, that's CNN, that's MSNBC. And they just get louder and more raucous and more opinionated and more one-sided every day. That's their right, but it's my right to say what I've just said about them. And so let's keep the marketplace of ideas open. There will be antitrust lawsuits, and we'll see how they develop, but let's put the First Amendment first. Our last call is from David in New York.
Alan, I don't understand the defending the president's remarks at the rally by freedom of speech. I don't think it's a freedom of speech issue. Anybody can say what he said, but he's president of the United States and took an oath to office. So he has to defend and protect the United States. He may have been free to say what he said, but I can certainly find that what he said violated his oath of office. Thank you.
That's a fair point, that the President of the United States is free under the First Amendment to say whatever he wants, but maybe his oath of office constrains him to protect the Constitution. Of course, he would say that he was protecting the Constitution, that he believes, you know, under the Constitution, he won the election, the electors, etc. You know his spiel. But he would say he was protecting the Constitution. Others would say he was not. But it raises a very interesting point about whether the First Amendment is fully applicable to the president. The First Amendment, after all, was designed to protect people in opposing the government. Does it also protect government speech? And the answer to that is, yes, it does. But politically, you can come to a different conclusion. You can say the president had the right to say it, but he was not right to say it. That's a perfectly consistent view, a nuanced view, but consistent. You'll hear nuanced views, hopefully consistent views, every time you tune into the Dirt Show. Thank you for listening and viewing. To keep the First Amendment alive and vibrant, please subscribe to the Dirt Show on YouTube, on iTunes, and now, most importantly, Rumble, the free media that doesn't censor. But wherever you want to subscribe, please subscribe to the Dirt Show. It supports the First Amendment, and by you listening to the Dirt Show and viewing it, you support the First Amendment. Thanks. An important part of the Dirt Show is your voice, your questions, your comments. Please call 24/7. The number is 216-710-0050. Keep your comments short and to the point. Again, the number for you to call 24/7 is 216-710-0050. Hard questions, criticisms, everything's fine. Just keep your questions short, and I'll answer them all on the Dirt Show.